got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Kevin, what's going on?
Oh, nothing. Just having fun dealing with anti-vaxxers, because as people receive vaccines and diseases go away, they tend to get a little ornery.
Yeah, I had an exchange a couple months ago where I said, you know, my wife's pregnant. She got vaccinated. And they're like, well, good luck with that, man. You know, she's going to fall over dead. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, I went back to the thread and I said, okay, she's still doing fine, and no replies.
Well, it said, well, you don't know the long-term effects. Like sometime when she's almost 100, she's going to die from it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's all that same rhetoric that was used around genetic engineering and glyphosate and, you know, in microwave ovens for that matter. You know, right. We don't know the long-term effects, so we probably shouldn't use it.
Yeah. Yeah. She got the vaccine and then bam, 60 years later, toast. Anyways, that's ridiculous. We're being ridiculous this day, but it's okay. Let's jump into our story. So first up, should food derived from CRISPR-edited seeds be labeled GMO? A lot of food retailers in Europe say yes, and this could actually prevent use of the technology over in the EU. Next up, glyphosate is great at killing weeds, but there are now some concerns that it could damage the microbiome of many insects, both beneficial and harmful. And then finally, dangerously high cholesterol may be treatable with CRISPR gene editing, and a new study in monkeys lends some support to this possibility. So Kevin, first up, let's talk about CRISPR-edited seeds being GMO.
Yeah, this is a really important story because the long-term implications of decisions being made in the EU could have profound effects on EU farmers and EU consumers. And what it boils down to, and I think the more you learn about this, the more clear it is that this is all about money. When you look at, and this story, it was originally written by a former Chicago mayor, Jane Byrne, at Feed Navigator. I think it's a different Jane Byrne. But at Feed Navigator, which is a super cool website, the basic idea is that the gene editing technology allows for scientists to make these precision changes in DNA that mimic the natural variation that's there in just breeding and selection. Only you can create the change rather than have to breed it in. So it allows you to make plant improvement much faster. The problem is, what does the final product look like? Well, genetically, there's no added hardware. It's not a GMO like in the old days where you added a transgene. This is a single base pair change or a small number of base pair change that is usually pretty innocuous and typically mimics a natural mutation. So what to do about it from a regulatory side? And the EU, I guess it was maybe in about 2018, where the European Court of Justice decided that this still would be regulated as a full-blown genetically engineered plant, even though it's the same as something that could have been bred over the course of, you know, 10, 20, 100 years. Well, more recently, it's been the regulators have stepped in and said, you know, maybe we better rethink this because this seems like a bad idea. We're cutting ourselves off from good technology. And the regulators said, well, we're going to stand by that decision. We're going to continue to hold that decision. And so it basically means that EU will not be able to enjoy rapid plant improvement, or at least not consumers won't be able to purchase products from those plants, and farmers won't be able to grow them anytime soon.
You know, it's funny you mentioned money, because I think that's absolutely the motivation here. And if you read the article, and I encourage you guys to do that, they never say anything about safety or about risk to human health or the environment. They come very, very close to saying, this is going to interfere with the premium brands we're trying to sell people. And they want to buy those. So, you know, you can't, this is the consumer's right, that kind of thing.
Right.
And what it smacks of to me is the concept from economics known as rent seeking, where basically you have some interest in society trying to push regulations that affect everybody but benefit them exclusively. And that's exactly what we're seeing here. And there seems to be no justification for it except, well, we've always done it this way.
Yeah, and it gets even slimier. What's really bad about this is that they come right out and say that it's really all about the expanding non-GMO and organic marketplace, that people are paying a premium for these. And so we don't want to confuse them by adding something that is maybe better and maybe an improvement and maybe better for farmers in the environment, but have a genetic engineering tweak that would eliminate it from being called non-GMO or from organic. And so they just want to make sure that there's a clear delineation. The thing that's a real bummer about this is that if you go into the major retailers, so Aldi and Lidl are these stores in EU, if you go into their websites and look at their policies, they all say, well, we respect consumer choice, and we're going to make consumer choice first, and we're going to follow the policies on genetic engineering. And if you go into their policies, they all say, well, we follow the policies of something called the Food Industry Association at FMI.org. And if you go to FMI.org and look at what they say, everything's just fine. There's no problem here. This is good technology. We love it, you know. So it's a way of them having it both ways, that, okay, we're following the science, but at the same time, they're saying, we're going to respect the consumer's choice and cater to the consumer's choice to not follow the science. And that's what's really weird.
Yeah, I think it's obnoxious. I think that's just the best word for it, because couldn't they do what we do here in the U.S., where you have the USDA organic label and then you have the non-GMO project? You could basically create a private labeling system, and you could contract with suppliers that don't use anything genetically engineered. I mean, I know that's kind of a spurious category anyway, but you could basically just preserve your supply chain as it is now, and then you could do what you want to do, and then you could cater to that group of customers. But they're not doing that. They're trying to like force this on everybody and prevent people from using it. That's the part that just kind of gets under my skin.
No, but you're exactly right. But I think that there's a certain level of protectionism in this for EU food supplying companies that can say we're non-GE, and also to kind of protect their farmers, because folks in Morocco and Turkey and other places just beyond the borders of the EU can produce at a much lower cost. And they can produce using genetic engineering in some of these places, no problem, if they chose to do it that way. So it's a way of kind of protectionism, keeping prices higher. And the problem is the people who lose are the farmers and the consumers. And also the environment. You know, the EU only has so much cropland. And to be able to say we're going to use a variety that's got a tiny little genetic tweak that can give you double the yield on the same space, you know, that'd be a step in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know who else has done this, but I know Henry Miller, who was a scientist at the FDA for a long time, and we've talked about him before, but he's really come out and said, we need to just get rid of all of these categories of GMO and gene edited and mutagenesis. I mean, those are real techniques for producing plants. But the point is that you're manipulating the genome of the organism no matter what you do. And so these are all artificial categories, and they're all kind of stupid, frankly.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's very true. I mean, there are different genetic alterations that you have to look at individually, but even more so, how do they affect the final product? Mm-hmm. And that's what we need to look at. And that's what we need to, and is there risk in it? And typically there's no evidence of risk. And so to be able to just have an honest dialogue is impossible when your lawmakers can't even get it straight.
Very good. All right, Kevin. Well, is glyphosate destroying the global insect population?
Yeah, and this is a really important paper because it's a good paper based on real research from a decent group. So let's look at what the strengths and limitations are. I really wanted to clear this one up. And this comes from Natalie Parletta at Cosmos. And it was a paper that, when this report came out, got quite a bit of play on Twitter. And this came out maybe about a month ago online. And it said, glyphosate dangerous to beetles as well as plants. And yes, we know it's dangerous to plants. That's why we like it. It makes them go away. And so what it basically boils down to is that even though glyphosate has extremely low toxicity to non-target animals, okay, you look at birds, insects, whatever, there's no acute toxicity until you're putting on a ton of the stuff. And as usually happens, the goalpost shifts. Okay, well, if it's not bothering the organism, maybe it's bothering the bacteria that are resident within and on the organism. And if that's the case, are there cases of symbiotic bacteria that you would see an effect? And so that was the hypothesis from this group at university part of Max Planck. They were testing the sawtooth beetle. Okay, so the sawtooth beetle is a common pest, and it has a symbiotic association with a kind of bacteria that has very little metabolism. It's got a very, very scant genome, and it does a couple things. And one of those things is make shikimate. And shikimate is a precursor to aromatic amino acids. So in other words, amino acids are building blocks of proteins. They come from, some of them come from this stuff called shikimate. If you can't do that conversion, you would die. Glyphosate works by inhibiting the last committed step in shikimate synthesis. Well, no, it's not the last, but next to last step in shikimate biosynthesis. So that's why glyphosate works. It shuts down the production of this important molecule, the class of molecules. And it does it in plants. It doesn't do it in animals. And it does do it in some bacteria, including this symbiont that lives with this grain beetle. So this is why this is important, is because when they did the study, they took the sawtooth beetle and they purged it of bacteria with antibiotics, and then they added back the symbiont with and without glyphosate, and then also with and without glyphosate with amino acids. So putting in the amino acids that they blocked chemically, and they were able to show very definitively that when you have glyphosate, you inhibit the production of aromatic amino acids and some of the downstream effects that are dependent on aromatic amino acids.
So as always, my question is, how well does this translate to the real world? You know, like for the insect that they're talking about, or maybe for, you know, some other kind of insect as well, how much glyphosate are they exposed to? And does this pose a real risk? Cause I mean, most people just aren't going to understand how this translates. So can you shed some light on that?
You got it. So what this means at this point is that when you have glyphosate present at 1%, which is the level at which you typically apply it, and the insect is in a certain larval stage, it appears to be sensitive to the herbicide, to the point where its skeleton, its exoskeleton, the hard armored outside, is a little bit thinner. So when you spray crop level insecticide onto the larval stage, it has a slightly thinner exoskeleton. Whether that is biologically significant, we don't know. I think that would have been a good thing to test. Does it make them more vulnerable or whatever? You know, who knows? But this is the important point. There's very few places that you're coming in contact with 1% glyphosate. If you get right under the spray nozzle, maybe you would. But I don't see that as something where, you know, farmers that spray this stuff and the residues are present, you know, for a few weeks, that doesn't cut it. Because when they did the experiment with 0.1%, you did not see the effect. So at 1%, the effects were minimal. At 0.1%, they were not detected. So it's an important study because it shows that you can affect the symbiont and see some long-term effect in the structure of the insect. But it doesn't say that it's deleterious to the insect. It also doesn't say that these are real field conditions. And those are two really important caveats.
Yeah, thank you very much for clarifying that. Because I think it was in the press release, and maybe they said it in the paper too, but I know for a fact in the press release, they said something like, and this is one of the study authors who said, this is useful research because we know insects are declining. And so maybe this gives us some kind of a mechanism for what's going on. Yeah. And I mean, maybe that's possible, but I think it's misleading in the sense that it implies that the insect declines are serious and we know exactly what's going on. And that's not quite true because I remember last June, I think it was, there was a pretty big study published in Science, and they basically said it's a little more complicated than saying pesticides or agriculture more generally is wiping out insects, because they found, just for example, like crop cover. So things like corn, soybeans, sorghum, cotton, et cetera, these kinds of crops are associated with increases in insect populations. And I know that at least several of those are heavily treated with glyphosate in the United States and in other countries. So in other words, there seems to be like whatever association there is, it's more complicated than what they uncovered in this study.
Yeah, I agree. And that is what the authors did infer in the paper as well, was, this could be the cause of the insect collapse and it really merits more study. And, you know, I can't disagree with them in that is the way that you would complete a scientific paper, especially if you're trying to find some funding to continue to look at it. You provide your most compelling argument. But when you look at it in terms of the realistic nature that affecting several subspecies of bacterial symbionts causing a collapse of insects, especially when the compound is only applied at certain times, it's not applied on too many crops in the EU and other places, and you still see insect declines. So it really is kind of reaching a bit. It kind of oversteps the data, but certainly is another piece of data that say that there can be unintended effects and things that we need to keep an eye on. And if you're spraying herbicide, make sure you're doing it correctly and safely.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just so we need to keep monitoring this and just pay attention to the evidence. Just a final question, if you know this or not, but has the EPA or has another group of scientists investigated this question? Because presumably, I mean, this stuff's been in use for like 40 years now, glyphosate, I mean. Someone must have looked at this in some capacity, or am I not right about that?
I think I don't think they look at this level of resolution. In this case, you're looking at the organisms that are alive and well inside a certain insect pest. And you're starting the whole idea of looking at microbiomes and metagenomes. This is really a residue of the last 15 years, going back the longest. So back when this stuff was approved, these kind of data didn't exist, which is exactly why we should look at them. But it's one of these things that we have to be very careful with the interpretations we find. Whereas one group may say the sky is falling, another group may look at the same data and say, well, this is actually saying we're in good shape because we're only affecting certain insects at certain times in their life cycle with a product that's being used at full strength that is only applied a couple times during the farming season. So, just that all depends on your lens.
Yes. Very good stuff. Kevin summarizing helpfully as always. Okay. Cholesterol and CRISPR. What's going on here?
Well, this is a really interesting article because the title of this one was Using CRISPR to Lower Cholesterol Levels in Monkeys by Bob Yerka at phys.org. And I thought, well, finally they've created a health hunk, they've made monkeys consistent with my heart healthy diet. I now can include a
low fat macaques.
You know why they call them Reese's monkeys, don't you? Because they got peanut butter on the inside.
Boomer joke.
Yeah. Okay. Well, anyway, this is the whole thing. This came up with a group from Verve Therapeutics. And what they did was something really cool. And this is also at University of Pennsylvania, was could you use an in vivo gene editing technique to affect cholesterol. And cholesterol synthesis and cholesterol metabolism, a lot of this is dictated by the effects of certain enzymes in the mammalian liver. And this paper is super cool because they targeted a gene called PCSK9. And PCSK9 is a specific gene which has an effect on cholesterol levels, mostly by binding with the low density lipoprotein. And so the low density lipoprotein, it's a molecule that binds lots of fat, or think of it that way. So you want lots of, when you have lots of LDL in the blood, it usually is a clinical association with increased risk of cardiovascular disease. So the idea here is you want to decrease the LDL levels. So scientists knew that there was ways to affect that with mutation. There are people who have lower cholesterol levels who have mutations in a gene called PCSK9. And this has to do with the uptake of LDL from the blood into the cells. So this is kind of, think of it as a little shuttle here. And so they did an experiment in macaques where you would use a version of CRISPR-mediated gene editing, but rather than editing the gene and having, which means breaking it and then having the repair process come back together in a sloppy way, they used something that targeted a specific base. And it's a much more surgical and much more precise way to do the gene editing. And when they did this, they were able to actually lower the levels in lower levels of cholesterol, of LDL cholesterol. And it worked. It lasted for a long time. So this is a pretty exciting finding.
So it's exciting for one, because this would be a great treatment, but it seems like it's showing that gene editing is getting more precise over time. Is that right?
Well, it is. I mean, this actually uses something called adenine base editor, which is a Cas CRISPR technique, but it's done in a way where you attach this enzyme complex to a specific enzyme called the deaminase. Without getting into too much detail, it is able to convert bases in DNA by removing a simple chemical decoration. And that's what it does, either in RNA or in DNA in this case. And so what they do is they add lipid nanoparticles, or they actually inject this into the liver, the enzyme complex with the target to attack this gene and make this change in the gene and inject this into the liver. And it turns out it works just fine. They've done it in mice before. They've done it in non-human primates in the macaques. And you're able to affect the function of those cells, which is super cool.
So I believe the researcher said the next step, if they could move forward with this, would be to test it in humans. So, I mean, would this go to like the first phase of a clinical trial at this point, if they get, assuming regulators would approve it? Because I guess there's some concern about this being a permanent change. And, we're kind of hesitant still to do that to humans.
Yeah, well, it could be, right? I mean, this would be gene editing in the liver, which, the cells are still dividing to some degree. And so this would actually be a permanent installation. So if you have a collateral effect of this, which could happen because, who knows, with this particular kind of thing. If you had a collateral effect, you could create an unstable state going forward, or a deleterious state going forward. So I think there's still a lot more research that needs to be done. But the exciting part about this is that if this kind of in vivo liver RNA delivery correction mechanism works, you can start taking on things, it's not just hypercholestemia. It's also polyketonuria, which is another, that's the reason, some folks can't drink diet soda, right? You see the warning on the can. It's an easily correctable genetic tweak that could be done this way. There's a series of diseases that function in urea cycle. These things could easily be corrected with gene editing if it works. So it's easily be corrected, right? It could be potentially corrected if the results that were observed continue. Let me say it that way.
Yeah, fair enough. I guess what I'm wondering is, and I'm just thinking out loud here, how would this be used? Would it be something like bariatric surgery? So like if somebody's morbidly obese and it's a risk to their health, you know, they'll staple your stomach. So I'm wondering if they would use this the same way. Like if your cholesterol is just so high that you're at risk of dying, they would use this as sort of a last resort. Would that be the intention, you think, of a treatment like this, you know, way down the road?
You know, I don't know on that one. I think that this could be something that in my mind is what would replace statins. So people take statins now to control their blood lipoprotein levels. This would be potentially a way that would replace it. This principle of how it works in some ways with the delivery is lipid nanoparticle based. So a lot like the COVID vaccine, you would take this special Cas9 complex and encapsulate it in lipid nanoparticles and inject it directly into the liver. Let it do its thing. And that's a pretty interesting science. I have a funny feeling that this is something that we will see in widespread use in the next couple of years.
Yeah, that's really cool. That's really cool. I mean, I don't have high cholesterol, so it doesn't directly affect me. So it's easy for me to go, yeah, go for it, you know, but it seems like, you know, if you can do it safely, it's a pretty important innovation. But we'll leave it there, Kevin. Who are you following on Twitter this week?
I'm following Jonathan Jarry, J-A-R-R-Y, at Cracked Science. And Jonathan has been a right-hand man to Dr. Joe Schwartz in the McGill University Office of Science and Society for a few years now, and is a really great guy who does really nice work, and I appreciate everything he produces. He produces good media and advertises those through Twitter. So what about you?
Well, I have one, but before I want to endorse yours, because there's been a number of times I've been writing something and I have a very specific question about, you know, like vaccine clinical trials or homeopathy or something like that. And I'm like, where am I going to find the answer to this? And then I Google it and McGill Office for Science and Society shows up and it's a perfect answer. I was like, this is great. This is what I need. So that was a good one. But I am following an account called @RealPeerReview. And I love this account because they basically keep tabs on bad social science research that's starting to become more prevalent. So one of the examples that I saw this week on their account was there's at least one or maybe several scholars in the social sciences who are saying we need to teach creation stories in public schools because, and this is a quote, they provide more insight into our connection with the land than Western science ever could. So it's not like, you know, this is an interesting artifact from history and we need to, you know, understand different cultures. This is like, no, we should just teach this because it's better than science. So that's just one example, but it's @RealPeerReview. And it's funny too, because some of the things that get into social science journals are strikingly stupid. Anyway,
yeah, so that's really a good one. That's a really important one. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you guys for joining us. As always, follow us on Twitter @CamJEnglish, @KevinFolta. We will be back next week. But in the meantime, subscribe to the show, download, retweet, give us lots of likes, review it. And if you're really liking what we do, throw us a donation. It helps us expand the quality of the show, reach more people, pay our producer. Thank you guys so much. We'll be back next week.